Well, good afternoon. My notes tell me that we have some students here from Living World Lutheran High School. Would you please stand? Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Living Word.
Living Word. Living. They wrote world.
But it's the word.
A word. Okay. And which is it? Living Word, right? Thank you very much, and thank you, Justice Ziegler. She obviously knows the high school. So
that's where my kids went.
I know. Okay. Please. Thank you for joining us. Well, they are part of a program we run with the State Bar called Court with Class, so they're going to know a little bit about the case that you're going to argue to us today. Justice Hagedorn, oh, he's not sitting on this case. Have you had a chance to talk with him? Because he was the justice assigned to chat with the students. Wonderful. Glad to hear that. Well, and speaking of Justice Hagedorn, you'll see we sit five on this case, and there will be only five of us. Justice Hagedorn has never participated. Justice Ann Walsh Bradley has withdrawn from participation, so she will not be part of the decision-making body on this case either. So with those few announcements out of the way, I'll call our last case, State versus Brown. Are you prepared to proceed? Please do.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, Elizabeth Nash on behalf of Petitioner Courtney Brown. This Court should reverse the decisions of the Circuit Court and the Court of Appeals because Brown's Fourth Amendment rights were violated when the officer who pulled him over for failing to come to a complete stop at a stop sign prolonged the stop to investigate whether Brown was engaged in illegal drug activity without reasonable suspicion.
Would it have mattered to your argument about when Mr. Brown was asked to get out of the car? If it had been right away, could the officer have done that?
Yes, I think it's reasonable that if the officer had removed Brown from the vehicle at the outset of the stop, that possibly could have been permissible under MIMS.
Why would that make a difference?
MIMS permits an officer to remove an individual from a vehicle incident to the lawful mission of a traffic stop. MIMS does not permit an officer to remove a person from a vehicle to facilitate unrelated criminal investigation.
But didn't MIMS establish a bright line rule that it is always permissible to remove an individual from the car on a traffic stop?
If it is incident to the lawful mission of the stop. Rodriguez clarified and perhaps added some gloss onto MIMS that an officer cannot remove a person from a vehicle or take any other safety precaution to facilitate unrelated criminal investigation. And that's exactly what happened here.
But didn't we say that the reason there's a categorical rule that the police can always remove someone from the car is for officer safety?
Yes. In MIMS, the court explained that removing a person from the vehicle is tied to the government's interest in officer safety.
And that's always an issue at every stage of a traffic stop, yes?
Not if it is used as an effort to facilitate ordinary criminal investigation. So that's the distinction that Rodriguez makes, is that the government's interest in officer safety stems from the mission of the stop itself. There's no independent basis for an officer to take safety precautions outside of the scope of the mission. And so if an officer has detoured from the mission at any point during the stop and takes precautions, whether they're safety precautions or otherwise, to facilitate that unrelated investigation.
Are you saying then that it is the officer's subjective intent for removing him from the car that made it unlawful?
I think that's one piece of the inquiry. I think
Have we ever said that the officer's subjective intent is relevant to the constitutional analysis?
Yes, I think there's one example. This court has repeatedly said in State against Kyles and State against Buchanan that an officer's fear or his belief that his safety or another officer's safety might be at risk is part of the totality of the circumstances inquiry that this court engages in when assessing the reasonableness of a frisk under Terry.
Can you look at this objectively, too, though? I know the officer said he wasn't concerned with is safety, and that's certainly a piece. But objectively, if your concern is for safety and you're stopping an individual and you let him sit in his car where he might access this supposed weapon while you go back and find out that he is, in fact, has convictions for prior drugs, and then you decide to ask him to get out of the car, as a totality, doesn't that speak more toward investigation as opposed to safety?
Yes, I think the objective facts here support Officer Deering's testimony that this was a search for drugs. And that's because Officer Deering did not remove Brown from the vehicle at the time he initiated the stop. He didn't do it at any point during the course of the stop. By the time he reapproached Brown's vehicle, he'd already written the warning. And so there's the objective facts, I think, support that testimony. And there is one thing, Justice Dowd, that I'd like to clarify. Officer Deering did not testify that he was aware that Brown had any convictions of any kind.
Arrests.
Correct. Officer Deering was aware that there were some prior arrests, and I believe he testified that he was aware of three, or at least there were three that were listed in the report. But here I think
when we look at an officer removing a person from, we don't look at the totality of circumstances, do we? The United States Supreme Court simply said that is something you can do.
I think that Rodriguez requires that this court looks at the totality when looking at why an officer removes somebody from a car.
And what particular part of Rodriguez would you be referring to?
So in Rodriguez, the court explains that safety precautions taken by an officer to facilitate a detour into unrelated criminal investigation are not permitted. And so in order for this court to assess whether the officer has detoured and is engaged in an ordinary investigation, or whether or not the officer is diligently pursuing the mission of the stop, I think we have to look at everything in its totality, including the officer's testimony, including the objective facts.
If we went that direction, would we have to overrule or modify Floyd?
No. The parties in Floyd didn't dispute that the officer in that case had not detoured from the mission of the stop, and that Floyd's removal from the vehicle was permissible. I think
But the circumstances were really close to this, weren't they? The removal from the car came at the end of the stop, right?
Correct.
Okay, and the removal from the car in this case came at the end of the stop. Yeah? Okay. So we have testimony, there was testimony in Floyd that he removed the person from the car so that he could then explain the ticket that he was receiving. And then at that point he asked if he could do the search. Similarly here, so where's the distinction between Floyd and this case?
Well, I think actually there's a couple of distinctions. The first is that the officer in Floyd did testify that he removed the driver from the vehicle to explain the citations. And certainly in Floyd, the second factual distinction is that made sense. One of the citations that the officer was issuing was for failure to have a driver's license. And so when the officer removed him from the car, he wasn't going to be able to drive his car away. It made sense that the officer would remove him, explain the citation.
That wasn't part of the rationale, though.
So. That was cited by this court on two occasions in the opinion, noting that both the trial court and the court of appeals placed weight on the fact that...
But we didn't.
The court, I think, cited the testimony the officer about explaining the citations and credited that testimony. We have no similar testimony to that effect here. Officer Deering never testified that he needed to explain the citation, and certainly that makes sense. It wasn't even a citation, it was a warning for failing to wear a seatbelt.
So do you think Floyd stands for the proposition that as long as the officer had the subjective intent of explaining the citation, that made the removal from the car constitutional?
No, I don't think that the officer's subjective testimony is dispositive. I do think that the court has to look at the totality of the circumstances, including the objective facts. But I think the case that's factually analogous to this case in all material ways is Rodriguez. And in Rodriguez, there are really two obvious differences between Rodriguez and this case. The first is that the officer in Rodriguez had already issued the citation before he removed Rodriguez from the vehicle and performed a dog sniff. But the Supreme Court said that's irrelevant. Doesn't matter whether the ticket has issued first or after, it's still a problem. The second factual distinction is that in Rodriguez, the officer used a dog to perform the search. And here, Officer Deering wasn't able to procure a dog. But that doesn't make his...
But the concern in Rodriguez was identifying the point at which the stop was over, right?
Correct.
Okay. So in the issuing of the citation is not necessarily the end of the stop, but in Rodriguez, as it turns out, it was. There was nothing that occurred after issuance of the citation that had anything to do with the stop, right?
Correct.
Okay. But issuing the citation certainly is a part of the stop.
Yes.
Okay. And when we look at this, we're trying to figure out, has there been any kind of an extension of the stop? And that's the concern. Yeah. So in this case, issuing the warning, that's certainly part of the stop, right?
Correct.
Okay. So the stop was not done until he issued the warning.
The stop, the question in Rodriguez is whether the stop is complete or reasonably should have been completed.
Right. So in this case, it couldn't reasonably be completed until he issued the warning.
Yes, I think it could be. And I think the reason why is because an officer has to be reasonably diligent in performing every aspect of a traffic stop. So an officer can't withhold a citation or a warning, for example, to buy more time to engage in unrelated criminal activity or to do anything else. The officer has to be diligent in handing over the warning.
Yeah. So where was the lack of diligence here?
So when the officer returned to Brown's vehicle, he had already determined he was going to engage in an investigation for illegal drug activity. And so instead of handing over the warning, telling Brown to wear his seatbelt in the future, what he did was he removed Brown from the vehicle, restrained his hands behind his back, walked him to the squad car, asked him whether he had anything the officer should know about, and asked for consent to search. Officer Deering testified that none of that was related to officer safety. The stop wasn't high risk. There was no particular concern that Brown was armed. He did all of those things to facilitate his investigation into ordinary criminal activity.
So where does the constitutionally problematic aspect start? Is it restraining his arms? Is it walking him to the squad car?
I believe that Brown's position is that it's when he removes him from the vehicle. So the first step that the officer takes that's not related to the stop's mission, that's related to a facilitation of this investigation, is problematic. But certainly the other actions that the officer took are no less problematic. All of those actions were taken as part of the investigation into drug activity, and so all of those actions would be constitutionally problematic. And I think to answer a little more clearly the question about the time, certainly, we're looking at when the stop reasonably should be completed. And so an officer can detour from a stop at any point. Something doesn't become constitutionally problematic because it occurs after the ticket has issued or after everything is complete. It can become problematic at the beginning, at the middle, or at the end, so long as the officer's actions are adding time to the stop and are unrelated to the mission.
Counsel, do we know the exact time that he was removed from the car?
We do not. There was no testimony elicited at the suppression hearing about the precise amount of time that each one of these actions took, and I think that may be partially related to the fact that the state conceded in the trial court that none of Officer Deering's actions were related to the mission of the stop. But we do know that each of those actions took a measurable amount of time. So removing Brown from the vehicle took time. Walking him to the squad car took time. Asking him whether he had anything on him that the officer should know about took time. Asking for consent to search took time. All of those things added time to the stop and were unrelated to the stop's mission. And I think another thing that's important here is that, you know, again, there was nothing happening simultaneously that was mission-related when Officer Deering engaged in these actions. So sometimes we have cases where there are two officers on scene, for example, and there's a simultaneous mission-related activity going on, and a different officer is engaged in a criminal investigation. And so long as those things are happening simultaneously and the criminal investigation isn't adding time, those things are permissible.
Does it also matter what specifically they asked him? Because if they really were concerned about safety, the question would have potentially been, do you have any weapons? Instead, the question was, do you have anything on you I need to know about? And then the follow-up was, mind if I search you to double-check? Do those words lend anything to this analysis?
Yes, I think that in Floyd, the particular question asked by the officer was whether or not Floyd had weapons. Here, the question was much broader than that, and I think adds to the idea that Officer Deering was not pursuing any safety-related activity or anything related to the mission of the stop. Truly, what he was doing here was searching Floyd for drugs, and he was doing that solely because he couldn't get a drug dog. There was no drug dog on duty that night to do it for him. So this was the action that he decided to take. And it does matter. The words that the officer uses, I think, does matter and does shift this in a totality. If you're looking at totality, suggesting that Officer Deering is engaged in an investigation for illegal drug activity. I also think that the main sort of question here about Mims and removal, again, is that Rodriguez is a case that comes after Mims. Rodriguez is factually analogous in all material ways, and Rodriguez is the case that controls here. It isn't Floyd, it isn't Wright, it's the United States Supreme Court decision in Rodriguez.
So help me out, if you could, with the question of consent. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Brown pled no contest prior to the court addressing whether the search was consensual. So what does that do to the consent issue?
So the trial court did address the consent issue. At the outset of the suppression hearing, the court noted that consent was being contested. There was testimony elicited at the suppression hearing about consent. Brown testified that he did not consent to the search. Officer Deering testified that he had. And what the trial court did here was deny the motion to suppress while assuming that Brown consented. That's erroneous. The trial court cannot deny the motion to suppress without making a factual finding, about Brown's voluntary consent. And so that was really the error here, is that the assumption of consent is not the same thing as a factual finding, and the trial court had to make a finding and had to resolve the factual dispute that the parties had put before it.
And was consent raised on appeal?
The Brown's appellate counsel did, in the appellate brief, note that there was a factual dispute about consent, noted that there was conflicting testimony, and noted that the Court of Appeals would not be the proper place to resolve that factual dispute on consent. So I think it was part of what was raised in front of the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals did interpret what the trial court did as holding that issue of consent in abeyance, but I think that's not quite accurate. I think what the trial court did was it made an assumption where it needed to make a factual finding.
Was the issue raised on appeal to a sufficient degree that we could look at it and say, yeah, that's a substantive discussion of the issue, or would we say, that was not developed?
It was developed by the state in its response brief, and it was responded to briefly in the reply by Brown's appellate counsel. So I think the primary thing here is that the issue of consent is going to have to be resolved because there was a denial of a motion to suppress without a factual finding on consent. And so Brown's position is that the most expedient way to handle this is if this court believes that the stop was not unlawfully prolonged, that the court should still remand the case to the trial court to enable it to make a factual finding on consent. And shifting gears, so if the stop was prolonged, Officer Deering would have had to have had reasonable suspicion in order to prolong the stop. And here, the Court of Appeals didn't address reasonable suspicion. It decided that the stop was not prolonged, but the trial court certainly did and concluded that Officer Deering had reasonable suspicion. And that's erroneous. Officer Deering did not have reasonable suspicion here. What we really had was Officer Deering interpreting a set of innocent facts as suspicious merely to confirm his hunch that Brown was up to no good. The facts that Officer Deering testified to were that Brown was driving a rental car. He happened to be on a dead-end road. It was nighttime. Brown was from Milwaukee, which is a source city for drugs, and that Brown had a prior arrest history. But none of those things individually or in their totality would lead a reasonable officer to believe that Brown had been engaged in drug activity, was engaged in drug activity, or was about to engage in drug activity.
I think you did a good job of showing how each one of the points upon which the officer relied in isolation would be insufficient. But, of course, we look at the totality, right? So let me just read out the circumstances the way the officer described them. So Mr. Brown was in a rental car in Fond du Lac on a visit from Milwaukee, a known source city for drugs. He was driving out of a dead-end street with nothing but closed businesses at almost 3 in the morning, allegedly after visiting his girlfriend, whose last name he did not know. So, put all those together, that sounds a little bit different, doesn't it?
No, I think that all of those things, again, they're not necessarily particularized to Brown's conduct. So he's on a dead-end street, but there was no testimony from the officer that that dead-end street was an area where drug activity occurred. It wasn't necessarily a high-crime area. He was driving a rental car, but there was nothing particular about his conduct suggesting that that rental car was engaged in drug activity. So there are cases that say that drug traffickers use rental cars, and I concede that that's something that this court can look at, but that conduct has to be particularized. It can't just be that any person in a rental car is suspicious. It has to be that there's something about that individual's particularized conduct related to that rental car.
But if it's somebody in a rental car with prior arrests for possession of cocaine, driving out of a dead-end street with nothing but closed businesses at almost 3 in the morning, and when asked what he'd been up to, he said he's visiting his girlfriend, whose name he doesn't know. That sounds kind of suspicious, don't you think?
Well, I think that Officer Deering interpreted the facts to support his hunch. So I think he had a hunch that there was something going on, and he interpreted all of those innocent facts in their totality as amounting to something that wasn't there. Brown did know his girlfriend's name. He didn't know her last name. But again, you know, having a casual acquaintance is not evidence of criminal conduct.
Well, he did describe her as his girlfriend.
Well, Brown testified that it was his friend and that he met her online. The record is not clear about how long they knew each other or, the extent of their relationship. But
I know he testified that in the hearing, but he told the officer he'd been to see his girlfriend.
That's what the officer wrote in the report, correct, girlfriend. But again, I think when we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, we can choose to look at these facts through the lens of a hunch, or we can choose to look at these facts objectively. And objectively, none of these facts, even with an arrest history, even with Brown perhaps not giving as much detail as Officer Deering wanted.
Well, perhaps he'd best learn her last name before Valentine's Day.
But not knowing her last name, again, I think it maybe is suggestive of the type of relationship that they had or the extent of the relationship, but it doesn't lead to any kind of reasonable inference that criminal activity was afoot.
What is the rule that you would like us to employ if we go in your favor? And do we need to overrule any cases?
No, this court would not have to overrule any cases. I don't think this case falls underneath either Floyd or Rodriguez, which are the two cases that were cited by the Court of Appeals. And I don't think that I'm asking this court to apply any specific rule. Each of these Fourth Amendment cases has to be looked at on their individual facts. And they're, in fact, intensive inquiries. We're not looking at bright line rules or anything like that. But I think that the rule that I would be asking the court to apply broadly is simply the rule that was outlined in Rodriguez, which is that on-scene investigation into unrelated criminal conduct is impermissible, and safety precautions taken to facilitate those detours are similarly impermissible. The facts here support a conclusion that Officer Deering removed Brown from the vehicle not as a safety precaution related to the mission, but as a safety precaution to facilitate his unrelated criminal investigation.
Unseen investigations into unrelated criminal conduct can't have safety considerations? Is that what you said?
No. And so on-scene investigation into unrelated criminal activity detours from the stop's mission and is not permissible. Safety precautions that are taken to facilitate those detours are similarly impermissible. So an officer, here's an example. If an officer has removed a person from a vehicle to facilitate ordinary criminal investigation, that will always be impermissible unless it's happening simultaneously with some other mission-related activity. So unless it doesn't add any time to the stop.
Or unless there's reasonable suspicion.
Correct. Or unless there's independent reasonable suspicion to have expanded the scope of the mission to engage in that unrelated criminal investigation. But an officer has to have independent reasonable suspicion to expand the scope of any traffic stop to investigate something other than the traffic infraction that gave rise to the stop in the first place.
So can an officer ask someone to get out of the vehicle for a traffic stop?
Yes, so long as that removal of the person of the vehicle is related to the mission of the stop. An officer cannot do that if that action is taken to facilitate an investigation into unrelated criminal conduct. And in order to determine whether or not the officer has done it as a safety precaution or has done it as a way to facilitate unrelated investigation requires this court to look at the objective facts that we were talking about, the officer's testimony, explaining why he did what he did, how he did what he did, and how the stop unfolded. So I think these are always going to be somewhat fact-intensive inquiries, but here the facts are clear. Officer Deering was not engaged in any kind of safety precaution related to the mission. Every action that he took from the time that he reapproached Brown's vehicle was designed to facilitate that unrelated criminal investigation.
I'm just trying to think back on sitting on suppression motions like this on the trial bench, and one of the things that a court would sometimes look at is whether or not the stop was complete, because oftentimes it's like, okay, you're free to go. By the way, do you mind if I search your car? And it was clear. The stop was complete. You're free to go. But the conversation continued. And so what do you do with those now, that the officer just must walk away, never can ask that second question? Because that creates a little bit of tension between completing the stop, letting the person know they're free to go, and yet engaging in the analysis you're asking. So maybe when you come back up, you can address that.
Would you permit me to answer, or would you like me to answer?
If I do, then I give counsel extra time, too. It's your choice.
Okay. I can answer very briefly. I think that those cases are slightly different. If the officer has told the person that they're free to go, that is then whatever actions he takes after that are analyzed under a different test. If the stop is ongoing, the person is still lawfully seized, then we get into the question that we're dealing with here, which is whether the stop reasonably should have been completed, whether the officer's actions added time to the stop.
Okay. Thank you. And you'll have some time in rebuttal. If you can set your clock to give opposing counsel 2 minutes in addition to his 30 minutes. Thank you.
May it please the court, I am Assistant Attorney General Michael Sanders representing the state. The stop and the two questions that the officer asked in this case were justified for two reasons. One, they were related to officer safety. They were part of the mission of the traffic stop, and they did not extend the stop. And two, the officer had reasonable suspicion that Brown was involved in criminal activity. I'd like to start with the first one. This case is essentially Floyd and Wright. It's not Rodriguez. It's Floyd and Wright. To start with, the stop was not over. Once the officer wrote the seatbelt warning, that can't end the stop. As the Supreme Court has said in Arizona v. Johnson, a traffic stop ends when the officer has no need to control the scene and informs the driver he is free to leave. In Floyd, the court said that the stop isn't over at least until he goes back to the car and gives the driver the citation or the warning and has an opportunity to explain it to him. And I assume at that point says, and you're now free to leave. Because at that point, he isn't seized. But until that point, the stop hasn't ended.
What about this being prolonged? The way that defense is arguing is that, yes, he still had to hand him a warning for a seatbelt violation, which doesn't take a whole heck of a lot of explanation, wear your seatbelt, but instead chose to prolong this stop by, at that point, after he'd been sitting in this car for however long it took the officer to do what he was doing in his car, he now asks him to get out. I mean, objectively, isn't that prolonging the stop at that point for purposes of investigation, which we know is what he was really doing?
That isn't all he was really doing. He said, I went up to him and I asked him out of the car, which MIMS is a per se bright line rule. As this court has said, as the U.S. Supreme Court has said, it is a bright line rule that during the entire traffic stop, you can ask the person out. It's a bright line rule. This court said that in Wright in a unanimous opinion last term. And nothing has changed. So that part is just wrong. It is a per se bright line
rule.
Kind
of an extension of what we said.
No.
We didn't really address that point in Wright.
The court said it is a rare bright line categorical rule under the Fourth Amendment. In the interest of officer safety, a police officer may order a driver out of his or her vehicle for the duration of the traffic stop.
In this case,
he did exactly
safety.
That. He said, I asked him questions because I wanted to know about both weapons and drugs.
Yeah, but you know what he didn't use really the word bugs weapons. Me about this stop is, what? Why did he have to take the man's hands, put him behind his back, then march him down to the squad car, okay? You know, I know he's got two officers standing right next to his car, so there are three officers on the scene. I think there was no reason to march him back to the squad car, and there was no reason to put his hands behind his back and treat him as though he'd done something wrong besides not wearing a seatbelt.
I'm not exactly sure about that, because there was one point in the suppression hearing transcript where the officer said that he had the suspect follow him. So I'm not sure about the hands behind the car, about his hands, because he said that he also did something with his hands, or I don't know if that is what he said or if that's what Brown said, so I'm not 100% sure about that.
Well,
but
if
there was an extension, it was that. It wasn't anything else.
Mm-hmm.
He can always ask him out of the car. The stop was not over. I think that's just a...
Well, it wasn't over because he chose to continue it. But he had the ticket written. It was in his hand. He could have just given it to him, given his license back. Fine, if he wants to ask him to get out of the car, then that's not going to do much for his safety. But fine, get in the car and go.
True, but if that's true, then that is exactly Floyd. And this court said in Floyd that that's okay. You can hand it to him. You can ask him out. You can explain it to him. So if that's the rule that the court wants to reach, then Floyd has to be overruled.
But what is there?
And he's not asking for Floyd to be overruled.
What is there to explain? I mean, he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. If you were speeding, or if you had one of the taillights was out, or something that needs some explanation about why you were stopped. But he wasn't stopped for anything. He was stopped because the officer was suspicious. He didn't see he wasn't wearing his seatbelt till he came up to the car.
He was stopped because he rolled through a stop sign.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. That's right. That's right.
And that isn't what he was going to. He didn't. He chose not to
cite him for that.
But mm-hmm. he did have the seatbelt. And I guess I don't know how much longer it's going to take to explain you should wear your seatbelt, then you shouldn't drive if you don't have a license like in Floyd. It's kind of the same explanation. You can't do this, and each one should take a few seconds, and the court in Floyd didn't seem to have any problem with saying that you can ask him out of the car, because under MIMS you always can.
But did he move the driver back to the squad car employee?
I don't think I don't think so.
Okay.
I don't know that there's any law or rule that would say that when you ask a person out of his car, you have to speak to him right next to his car. It would seem to me that in terms of officer safety, you might want to move him a few feet away from his car. You might want to move him 20 feet away from his car. Either way, it's going to take a couple of seconds, and I don't think it really changes anything.
By putting their hands behind their back and moving them over to the squad car, though, I mean, even if we follow your logic, and I'm looking at Floyd, where the deputy took him out to explain the citations, even if we follow the logic and we say he could take him out under Floyd at that point for officer safety, quote unquote, even though he testified that wasn't an issue, didn't the extension then come from not just taking him out to explain the citation, which he did not do, but taking him out to then put his hands behind his back and move him over to the squad and have this very strange request of the guy, which is basically asking him, do you have drugs on you? It wasn't, do you have a gun on you? I mean, look at all those circumstances. Isn't there an extension at that point?
I don't think so.
Why not?
Well, he did not say, I did not have any concerns about officer safety. He didn't say anything along those lines. He said, I asked him questions because I wanted to know about whether he had any weapons or drugs.
He was asked specifically about officer safety, and he said there was no reason. That was not a reason why he took him out of the car.
Well, it is an objective standard about what would a reasonable officer think. And in this case, after the traffic stop, at that point, he may not have a whole lot. He didn't ask him out of the car up front because at that point, he didn't really have any reason. He thought, okay, he's in a weird place. It's late at night. He explained why he was there, and it didn't make a lot of sense. But he didn't then say, and now I want to ask him out of the car. He went back to his squad, ran his license, found out that he had a lot of arrests, including one for armed robbery, which, as an officer, I guess I would assume could involve a gun.
Where did you get that from? I don't see that in the transcript at all.
What? I don't know which
The
which
armed
part.
Robbery. You talked about arrests for drugs.
No, he 100% knew that he had an arrest for armed robbery.
Are you trying? So I'm trying to follow the logic here, because I thought what you were going to argue to us is that this was reasonable suspicion and that's the basis for the search, and not that he was somehow had feared for his safety, because he testified that he didn't. So, I mean, you're making a good argument that maybe he could have made, but I don't think that's what
the issue is. It's an objective standard, and I think if you're a reasonable officer, you would, if you're going to ask the person out of the car, that is a per se rule, because that is always going to be dangerous and there's always going to be officer safety, and you can always do it, and it's always because of officer safety. It's a per se rule in MIMS.
So how do you get Rodriguez? How do you reconcile Rodriguez?
It's
a per se rule, you could get him on in Rodriguez.
Yes. MIMS, or
the extension of the stop. You can never extend the stop.
It's the extension of the stop, though. In Rodriguez, the court did not limit MIMS where MIMS said you can always ask the person out. It cites it. It quotes MIMS. It said you can always do it. And then it didn't say that in that case where the cop asked the guy to get out of the car once he was completely done with the stop, it didn't say he couldn't do that. It said he couldn't then have him wait for a dog sniff. But there's absolutely nothing in that case which says that MIMS' bright line rule is wrong. Nothing. And this court in Wright last year, and in Floyd 3 years ago, and in Smith 2 years ago, cited MIMS for that same per se bright line rule, so long as the stop isn't over. That just hasn't changed.
Or Rodriguez added, or extended for purposes of investigation.
That is different, though. That is the extension of the stop.
Well, can't you extend the stop at any point? You're saying you can only extend the stop at the very end?
No. If you do something in the course of the stop which isn't related to the mission of the stop, that can extend it. But he didn't do anything here during that period. There isn't any claim that he couldn't call for dogs, that he couldn't call for to get help with the stop from the two cops who showed up, then he couldn't do any of that. There is no claim until he walked up to the to Brown's car. At that point, the stop isn't over, and he's wasted zero time. He's done nothing wrong. So at that point, he can ask him out of the car. It's a per se rule.
And he can and put his under hands Floyd, behind his back and walk him to the squad car.
That's the only thing which isn't Floyd.
Okay, so is
in
that
terms
the
of
part
the question,
where
it's
extended?
Floyd. What's that?
Is that the part where the stop was extended, that reasonable suspicion is required in order to do that?
Well, there isn't anything on the record that explains how long that was. And so the question, and so it's not clear if he walked him back a foot, 20 feet. I don't think there is anything in the record. There also, I don't think, is anything in the record that says that if, that you can't do that in terms of promoting officer safety. Like, I don't think there's any case or any law that says that you have to do it right there next to his car. That you can't move him a couple of feet to
saying
talk about it.
Saying you have to do it, what was the it?
Well, he went up, and he may have been wanting to explain the citation. As it turns out, once he asked him if he had anything on him, and he said no, and then he asked if he could search him, and he said either yes or no, depending on who
you
believe.
But he never used any of the time after he got him out of the car to explain the citation, right?
Because once he got him, once he had him out of the car, he did exactly what Floyd was, which is you then ask him if he has anything on you, because you still want to make sure he doesn't have a gun on him, or in this case, a gun or drugs. But he was asking about the gun. So when he asked him that, it's just Floyd. And then once he said no, he asked if he could check. Then he checked, and he found drugs. So at that point, he's not going to say, oh, and here is your seatbelt warning, and I kind of want to explain this now, because he had just found a bunch of crack.
But, you know, why doesn't he have to stay on track? Why can he deviate to search him?
Because under Floyd, you can. He can
him
get
back
him out
to
of
the car. It doesn't say in anything I've read how far the car was.
There isn't anything in the record, which is unfortunate, and I think it's because this stop happened in 2013, pre-Rodriguez or any of the other cases.
And pre-body cams? There were no body cams.
There was no body cam. There was a squad cam, but unfortunately there is no video.
It was lost or malfunctioned or something.
Something happened, yes. So there is no video. So they didn't ask the officer how far it was, how long it took. Brown took the stand. He didn't say how long it took, how far it was. There's nothing in the record that would make it any certain period of time. Or even if that wasn't part of the mission of the traffic stop, which I think it was, because I don't think that it makes sense to have a rule that when you ask a person out of the car, you can't then move him a little ways.
Okay, well,
just in terms of officer safety.
Your second argument was, even if he extended it, he had reasonable suspicion to do so. Tell me what your best argument.
Before you I don't have a problem with
that,
but do your best to distinguish this from Rodriguez.
In Rodriguez, it was okay to, when the stop was completely over, in the sense that he said, here is your citation, you are free to leave. And then he said, oh, but I want you to wait for a dog sniff. He then had him get out of the car when the stop was completely over, which is not this case. Then he then had him wait. And until the dog got there for the sniff, it took 8 minutes. This at most, he asked him two things. One is, do you have anything on you which I need to know about, which takes absolutely no more time than, do you have any weapons on you that I need to know about? So even if that question involves both drugs and guns, as opposed to just guns like in Floyd, it didn't take any extra time. And his next question is, may I search you? Which, again, would have taken absolutely no more time than had he said, may I search you for a gun? And under Floyd, that's fine. And if it's different because he didn't say weapon, or he didn't say gun, he said anything, that didn't take any extra time. And in Wright, this court said that the the cop can ask that can go past the gun question and go into something which is not related to the mission of the stop, so long as it does not measurably extend the stop. Here it added no seconds.
Understood. Now the reasonable suspicion, 244, Fond du Lac, dead end cul-de-sac, doesn't know girlfriend's name, rental car, what else do you have?
Well, once you get to that point, I would expect that he would think, okay, this is a little strange. It's late at night, it's in a place where you wouldn't expect anyone to be. He is in a car which he doesn't own. It's a rental. He knows about that. He talks to him. He finds out he is from a city where he knows that a lot of people sell drugs, and they come from there. And it's likely that if you're going to do that, it's going to be in a car you don't own. So then when he goes back to the squad, I don't think at that point he thinks, okay, he is here to deal drugs. But then once he runs his name and finds out that he has a lot of arrests, including a lot of arrests for drugs, and one for cocaine with intent to deliver, and some pot crimes, and an armed robbery arrest. And it's not entirely clear what he knew, but at the time, he not only had an arrest for cocaine with intent, he had a conviction for it in 08.
And you're saying there's something in this record that says the officer knew about this armed robbery conviction?
I don't know if it's clear that he knew about the conviction, but he 100% knew about the arrest. And I guess I would think that if it is an objective standard, a reasonable officer who saw online what he had would have known that it was a conviction, because it actually was a conviction.
He says he was asked if it was considered a high-risk traffic stop. He says no. No concerns that Mr. Brown had any sort of weapons. He could have, but there was no specific factors to lead to that. So he certainly didn't think that the armed robbery conviction played into this at all.
I wanted to go back to have you finish up that question about what's your best argument for saying there's reasonable suspicion. And the only thing you told me is he went online, ran his name, and he had a lot of arrests, one of which may or may not have been for armed robbery, but certainly for a lot of different kind of drugs. Anything else besides what he found online?
Well, what he found when he first saw the car, it was quite late at night.
Well,
at a time
for young
when
people, 2:44 in the morning, let me tell you, it's not a lot.
He wasn't that young, for what that's worth, but in that town, the cop thought it was strange to see a car at that time of the night in that place where there isn't anything open. And then once he spoke to him and he said, well, I came from a house, I don't know where, I was with my girlfriend, I don't know her last name, where are you going? And he answered, nowhere really. So he's thinking this is a little strange. Oh, he also asked him where he was coming from, and he said, I was at a Speedway gas station. And he asked, and you came right from there? And he said, yes, and the cop knew that that's not where that gas station was.
Well, he testified, though, that he pulled into this dead-end street because he was going the wrong direction and turned around because he wanted to go the other direction for whatever.
Well, he said that, but he didn't say that that's what he said at the time. So when he was asked questions, he didn't give answers like the ones he gave the judge. He told him, I came right from the gas station, which the cop knew wasn't true.
Okay, right from the gas station is so that's subject to interpretation. If you get lost and you turn yourself around, aren't you still coming right from the gas station?
I suppose, but
that one just doesn't do a thing, I don't think.
It made the officer who was from that city think that it was a little strange.
The officer who also thinks that anybody from Milwaukee is involved in drugs.
If he's driving around in a rental car at 2:44 in the morning in a dead-end street of closed businesses.
Was there any testimony that more drugs are dealt at 2:44 in the morning in that area? I mean, there's nothing to tie that
in that area, no.
There's no testimony, period, about that time of night, even. This officer didn't make that kind of record.
Again, it's an objective standard, though, and I think it seems relatively clear, and there are cases, and I think I cited some in my brief, that these types of things do happen more often, and it's okay to consider the time of night.
Is there a
case, and this is really early in the morning.
Is there a case that says that looking at someone's arrest record is a factor in probable cause about whether they're currently violating the law?
Yeah, I cited it in a footnote, I believe.
Okay.
It was State v.
Buchanan?
Yes, okay. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
I don't remember where I cited it, but I pointed out that in the appellate court they had read what happened at the suppression hearing as him saying he had some convictions when he may have only meant arrests. So that was in a footnote in my brief where I pointed out that that might not be accurate.
So I'm not worried about whether it's an arrest or a conviction. I'm just worried about precedent that's saying that you can use as part of reasonable suspicion the fact that this person had other drug convictions.
Yeah, in that case, the court says you can. And it makes sense because there are lots of reasons that you could have an arrest and not a conviction, which are not that you didn't do it. I mean, there's a lot of different reasons where that could happen. And if you're on the street and you see this and you see, well, he has been arrested a lot of times for some cases involving drugs and one which was an armed robbery, or at least where he was arrested for armed robbery, it's probably something that you're going to want to consider, especially when you walk back up to the car.
Okay.
You're going to want to know if that's the case.
So
and in this case, he did, and that's why he wanted to ask him about both weapons and drugs. Yes?
So if you were writing this opinion, what would you want? I mean, what are you asking us for? Because I was thinking that it was about reasonable suspicion, but you seem to have multiple approaches. So what would you have us say?
Well, I guess you could go either way, whether you want to say that, like the trial court said, he had reasonable suspicion, and therefore the stop is fine. And not that the stop is fine, but that he could extend the stop to ask him questions. Or you could do what the appellate court did and say he didn't extend the stop because he asked him questions that were about both weapons and drugs. Under Floyd, you can ask about weapons, so there is no question he could ask him out of the car. There's no question he could ask him questions about weapons, and he asked him questions about weapons and drugs. So you could say it's Floyd, essentially, and to the extent that by saying weapons, he didn't say weapons and drugs. By the time he meant drugs, too, if that changes anything, that one word, then it's right because that didn't extend the stop at all.
What about
much less than a measurable extension?
What about the concern raised by Judge Riley about racial profiling targeting? Because if that's the case, if all this is exactly as you say, then the officer can make the determination anytime based on someone's color of their skin to determine that at that point that person is someone they're going to get out of the car. That person's someone that they're going to ask about drugs. That person's someone they're going to put their hands behind their back and walk into the squad car and then say something vague about, do you have anything on you, and go down that road. What about that?
I don't think that what he did there has anything to do with race. Mims says it is a per se rule. You can always do it. It can be anyone. It can be, as he pointed out, the white suburban soccer mom. And that's perfectly fine. You can always ask him out of the car. You can always ask him questions. And in this case, what you should keep in mind, I think, is that if this had been a white suburban soccer mom, it would be one who was out at 2:44 in the morning in a place where no one else is. You're not normally going to be. And then when you're asked, why are you there, you don't give an answer that makes a lot of sense, that the cop thinks is a lie, that it's just not truthful. And then you would also be a white suburban soccer mom who has been arrested many times for lots of drug crimes and for an armed robbery, and who actually had a conviction for cocaine possession with intent to deliver.
Well, now you've just inserted these facts. I'm just saying that.
But all of those are true, and so.
But it doesn't have to be any of that. It could be just the person who's got a different color skin who they decided that that's the person they're going to ask to get out of the car? Because you're saying your first part of your argument is you don't need the reasonable suspicion. So if that's the case, then they're only going to ask the people who look kind of like they might have done something, who might have a different color skin, who might be then, of course, guilty of whatever. I know they wound up finding drugs, but I'm saying to get there.
That's not why. You can ask anyone out of the car. It is a per se rule under Mims, and that's never been changed. This court has accepted that in Wright and Floyd and Smith. In the last case in Wright, it was a unanimous opinion that you can always ask the person out of a car while the traffic stop's going on. It's a per se rule. That has nothing to do with race. And he isn't contesting the stop, so that isn't part of it. It's in terms of whether you can ask him out, you can always ask him out. There isn't any question. And under Floyd, you can always ask him if he has weapons, and you can always ask him if you can search. It's the rule. There's a racial component.
You have to admit Rodriguez put some boundaries on that. What if he sat in his car? We don't know how long it took him to run all this stuff and to look for the canine. And if he had extended the stop, Rodriguez puts some boundaries on that. You have to admit that.
Sure, but there is nothing in the record that he's not even claiming that it took extra time to call for the dog, that it took extra time to ask for help. He's not claiming any of that took any time. He's only claiming that from the time he walked, he got done, he wrote the warning, from that point on, it took extra time, except under Floyd, it was fine to ask him out of the car, and it was fine to ask him if he had any weapons, and it was fine to ask him for consent to search. And he said, I was asking him about weapons and drugs. It's not just drugs. But if it were just drugs, it would still be fine, because in Wright, the court said you can ask unrelated questions so long as they don't measurably extend the stop. And those two questions did not extend the stop at all. So at most, all there is the time that it took to walk him from his car back towards the squad car, which couldn't have been more than a few seconds. I wouldn't think. I mean, I don't know how far it was, because again, it was a 2013 case, and there isn't any testimony. But it couldn't have taken long, and that would be the only thing that would extend the stop. And at that point, he was still going to ask him about weapons. So it didn't extend the stop because it was still while the stop was going, and it was in the mission of the traffic stop because it was about weapons and drugs.
In this instance, he consented to the search. Is there any contention that he did not?
He said he did.
It's a strange case on that point. The judge did not make a finding as to whether he consented to the search. According to the cop, he asked if he minded if he searched him. He said no, which means I can search him. He then searched him and found crack.
So should we send it back for a determination on that?
I don't think so, because the court said I will get back to that later. I want to hear from some more witnesses, which I assume meant the two cops who were on the scene. He wanted to hear from them too. But he then denied the suppression motion and then said, we'll come back to that later. The defendant then pled. At that point, I expect if on appeal he had said, well, I win on the ground that there was no reasonable suspicion, but if I lose, you should send it back for a determination of consent, that the state may have just asked him to send it back. But instead, he did not raise that on appeal. In the state's brief, the state said, well, he has abandoned it because he didn't raise it. And in his reply brief, and I don't have that with me, but it was on page 2 or 3, I think, he said, yeah, I did not raise that he said something along the lines of, to have that decided by this court, I ought to have raised it. I did not raise it. So he just abandoned the issue. So at this point, I don't see how the court could send it back if the state wins here, because you would be affirming his conviction, and I don't know what the court would do at that point. It would seem that the case would be over, and if he wants to move for post-conviction relief and move to withdraw his plea, he certainly could do that. But I don't know what else he could do since he's pled, and his conviction would be affirmed both by the Court of Appeals and here. So I guess just to wrap up then, I think for this court to find that the stop was extended and that the officer could not ask him, it would, I expect, have to overrule Floyd and Wright. With Floyd, it was fine to ask him out of the car. It was fine to ask him questions. What happened here was the same as Floyd. And if by not using the term weapons and by saying anything as opposed to any weapons, that means something, and now it's not about weapons, even though he said it was about weapons, then it's right. And it's okay to extend the stop for a very short period of time under right, as long as it's not a measurable extension. Here it plainly wasn't. So I think you can go that way, or you can find that it was okay because the officer had reasonable suspicion. If there are no further questions, my light's on, so.
It's good. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
I'd like to begin by addressing reasonable suspicion and clarifying a couple of things that the court asked about. The first is this armed robbery arrest. This was an arrest. It was not a conviction. If the court looks at page 4 of the PSI, there's a little bit more detail about the armed robbery. It was an arrest from over 10 years before the stop occurred, in this case, 2001. In addition to Justice Rogenczak's question about the arrest record, it's true that an arrest record can be used as part of the reasonable suspicion analysis, but this court has said on numerous occasions, both in the Beto case and in Anderson, that a person's arrest record is not dispositive in and of itself or sufficient in and of itself to provide reasonable suspicion. And so I think what the state is really asking for here is a determination by this court that once the officer saw that Brown had an arrest record, that it somehow turned the hunch, the inchoate hunch, into something more than that. And I think that's impermissible under Beto and Anderson. I think that would be improperly placing weight on the arrest record, contrary to this case, the case law of this court.
How do you address...
Counsel, can you point me to the part of the Court of Appeals briefs where the issue of consent was argued?
Sure. So the issue of consent was raised for the first time on appeal by the state in its response brief. The appellate counsel did discuss that on footnote 1 and also
the
main
brief or the reply brief?
No, in the reply brief.
Okay.
And then page 8 of the reply brief. In footnote 1 and page 8, he did identify that there was a factual dispute on the issue of consent. And noted that the trial court had not resolved that issue, and then also in footnote 1 said the Court of Appeals should not decide the issue of consent when it wasn't already decided by the trial court.
Well, he said that the issue of consent was moot.
That's correct.
So if he said the issue of consent was moot at the Court of Appeals, how is it that we can address it?
So I think... this is an issue sort of what's most expedient. I think the state is correct that if this case were to not be remanded, there would have to be litigation related to ineffective assistance of counsel or various other motions filed. The state seems to believe that withdrawing the plea would be an appropriate step at this point in time because of the failure to get a ruling or a factual finding on consent. And so I think, what we have here is maybe not the clearest argument about consent in the Court of Appeals, and that's unfortunate, but I think that the reality is that the issue of consent is going to have to be resolved by the trial court.
Why would it have to be resolved? Why can't we just conclude that he forfeited the issue?
Well, because I don't think he did. I think that appellate counsel did say that the factual finding was never made, and I think appellate counsel said that the Court of Appeals is not the appropriate place to make that determination. That would be in the trial court. And I'd like to address a couple of other things about the extension of the stop. The state focuses on Mims, and Mims is a bright-line rule. Brown is not arguing that it's not a bright-line rule. Brown is arguing that what Rodriguez says is that on-scene investigation into unrelated criminal conduct detours from the mission of the stop. Safety precautions taken to facilitate those detours also are impermissible. That is exactly what Rodriguez says. And so what happens is once we start removing somebody from a vehicle to perform a search, it's a slippery slope. Then we can start asking questions about whether they have a weapon, or we start asking questions about the officer's safety. But the reality here is that officer safety was not a concern. The officer testified officer safety was not a concern. And the only reason why officer safety even potentially could have become a concern was because he removed Brown from the vehicle to facilitate a search for drugs. And that is exactly the kind of factual scenario that Rodriguez says is impermissible. In Rodriguez, it was a dog sniff. And so it's a little bit easier to analyze because there's no question that the officer was engaged in a drug investigation. A drug dog can't be used for anything other than drug investigation. But here, Officer Deering was engaged in a drug investigation. We know that from his testimony and the objective facts. He cannot take safety precautions, whether that's removing somebody from a vehicle, restraining their hands behind their back, walking them to the squad car, asking for their consent to search. He cannot do those things to facilitate that unrelated criminal investigation unless he has independent reasonable suspicion to do so. That's what Rodriguez clearly said, and this case is clearly factually materially analogous to Rodriguez.
Thank you. Thank you very much for fine briefs and for... the court will be adjourning to reconvene in closed conference at 5 minutes after 3 o'clock. We are adjourned.